Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
Welcome, everybody, to the latest edition of IGN Unfiltered. I'm Ryan McCaffrey. This is our monthly interview show where we sit down with the very best, brightest, and most notable people in the video game industry. This month, I am very, very pleased to be joined by Sean Murray, the mastermind, the programmer behind No Man's Sky, one of the single most anticipated games of 2016. It's great to see you, Sean.
Yeah, thank you. That's a good intro. I like mastermind.
You like that? It's fitting. I mean, you've been the public face of this game, and it's funny. On that exact note, I'm curious because this whole game, it is a multi-quintillion planet universe that's all generated. It's obvious you can't do that by hand. You'd die first.
Right.
So it's all the game's built on algorithms you've talked about in the past. So my first question to you, and this is a genuine question. Do you consider yourself a genius? I'm being serious. You're laughing.
Yes, obviously.
No.
Like, I think...
No one's ever pulled this off before. Yeah. Do you consider yourself a genius?
Well, the game isn't out yet, so, you know, talk to me after that. No. I think I would say that the team at Hello Games...
And there are 12 of you?
Yeah.
Which is incredibly tiny by current standards.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, even for an indie team, it's small. Yeah. Right? Like, that's the thing that people don't realize is that, like, you know, like a lot of indie games will have teams of that size kind of thing. But the team that I work with, I think, are super talented. Like, and I would say they're some of the best people that I've ever worked with. They're incredible. And, yeah, I think they're doing, like, the best, like, genuinely the best work that they've ever done, you know. I think on No Man's Sky, I personally see it as some of the best work that I've ever done in my, like... time working on games kind of thing, and I've worked on a bunch of games in the past.
We'll talk about those.
definitely not genius. I think we're doing some clever stuff, but I just spend my entire time looking at other games. In fact, trying to finish No Man's Sky at the moment, I find that I can't look at other games because I just feel like inferior, and I look at anything else I boot up and they have some effect that we don't have, or they have some mechanic that we don't have, and I'm like, oh god, I can't put myself through this kind of thing.
Well, don't feature creep. We're coming out in June, right? Okay. So as the game nears the finish line now, right. You're in the home stretch as we sit here and record this. Is the game everything that you conceived of in your head several years ago when you first started making this in secret from the rest of your team?
I think that's a good question. Like, I'm just thinking about that. So, in some ways, it's a lot more. You know, like, we had an idea. Yeah. And, like, most times when you have, like, a game idea... It's never how you expect it when it comes out, right? It just changes and morphs as it goes along. No Man's Sky is a lot closer to the original vision than I would have expected, right? And I think part of that is just because people have been so excited by it and interested in it that you kind of feel like this confirmation, like, yeah, this is what we need to do kind of thing. So it's, I don't know that there's a good way to say this. It's very close to the original vision, but then I never would have expected a game to stick as closely to it as that, if you know what I mean. Yeah. So it's almost like more than what I would have expected, you know.
So I'm curious if, you don't consider yourself a genius, you just like your team, but because I've spoken to you enough over the course of this development where I can, your brain operates in a way that I can't even fathom. But so I'm curious, I'm just wondering, have you ever met John Carmack and have you showed him the game? Because he's a guy, I've interviewed him, he's another one. I consider him a genius. I mean, I'm not Mensa. I don't get to certify people.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
His same thing, where he just operates on a level that I can't fathom. So yeah. Do you have any kinship with him?
No kinship. I would say that it and Carmack, like, that's one of the reasons that I got into games. Like, I could think of two games, and I wish I had better kind of favorite games, all-time favorite games, right? I wish I had kind of niche titles that no one's ever heard of or something like that. But I have the most popular titles. So like Mario 64.
Sure.
And Quake, right. And they came out at a time kind of when I was a teenager.
Yeah.
Or just on that kind of boundary. And they really, like, they made me not just enjoy playing games, but think, how does a game even get made?
Yeah.
Like, I played Mario 64, played Quake, and I just thought they were so perfect, right? Like, so balanced, so designed, that you couldn't play them and not think, how does this get made? What process is involved here? I don't understand, especially because they were such leaps forward. It was like, this is the first 3D platformer.
Yeah.
Or this is the first proper first-person shooter.
And in a 3D yet, world.
In a 3D world, yeah, exactly, yeah. Like, in a fully realized, obviously, there had been Doom and stuff like that. And then Quake in particular, I just started reading up everything I could find out about, like, id and how they worked and stuff like that. And I had, I think when you play Mario, you don't really necessarily get a sense of the team that made it, but when you play Quake, you really did. So you got a sense that, like, I'd read these names like Romero and Carmack and stuff like that. And I thought, like, you know, I thought Carmack is probably, like, super intense and clever and stuff like that. And then the more I read about him, he was, you know. And I thought, like, the kind of levels that they're building and stuff like that, I pictured Romero with, like, long hair and being into metal and stuff like that. And he was, you know. And you got a real sense of that. Like, you could play the game and just the little touches they had put in and the music and stuff like that. So yeah, they are like they are, id in particular, were like massive aspirational figures. Carmack, yeah, incredible. Like, he is, he does definitely operate on a whole other level.
Well, I've never met him
or anything, no. And I don't know, I would just fall to pieces, I think, if I did, yeah.
I did when I interviewed him. I know the feeling. So let's go back to your childhood. Let's go back in time here. Let's figure out how you got to this point where you're making this multi-quintillion space exploration game. You wrote your first game at age 6. It was a text adventure. What was it called?
I don't even remember. It probably didn't have a name. So I had an Amstrad at the time, which is a computer that you guys in the States wouldn't have. It was like a Commodore 64, right? And it was, yeah, it was like green screen and terrible keyboard and stuff like that, and tape. And, yeah, I had such... My brother, I've got a brother who's like 6 years older than me, and he was really... He was just starting to get into programming and stuff like that. And so I just wanted to do everything that he did, kind of thing.
Are they, like, super jealous of you now that you're this incredibly brilliant programmer?
I have, like, I have four brothers and sisters, and they all do far more important things. They all do, like, they're all doctors of some sort kind of thing, or do something to, like, help the world and, you know... Yeah.
So around the Christmas table, you're like, so Sean, what have you been doing?
Yeah,
making a game about space.
Yeah, I'm the black sheep. It was always playing video games and, not a proper job, right? So,
it is to us.
Right, yeah. This is the one place, IGN, I can be accepted. The... yeah, so
you don't
I got
remember
it.
The name of that? You don't remember
no,
the
I don't.
Text
but
picture?
It was all, I mean, I happen? Made so many. Like, I made so many, and it was all just such, like, it was literally basic programming, but it was such basic stuff where, like, you know, it would be incredibly embarrassing, but it would be the kind of thing where it would be like, you know, you're in a forest, there's an opening to the like to the east, or there are some caves to the north, or
walk
whatever.
Walk to the caves,
and you would type in like you know caves or whatever, right? And then I had such poor grasp of like game design that it would just be like you walk to the caves, you died. You know that kind of thing. That was basically that was my game at like 6 years old, but. Like, it is interesting.
At six, that's amazing.
No, it's not.
But I'm playing with Tonka trucks at age six.
But it's really, like, simple stuff. But it's funny because it got to the point where I could, like, let other people play. And, yeah, you just quickly learn how stuff like that doesn't work, whereas right. it does in your head, right? You know, and so I made little things that were more advanced. But I think actually I made, like, I would just make so many unfinished things, like, constantly. Like, I was constantly, that's the thing that my brother would always say to me, that I was, like, 50% playing games, 50% making broken stuff, basically.
Do you still have any of those old experiments?
I have some stuff. I used to do demos on the Amiga. So, you know, I don't know if you know, but like this is like a demo scene where you would just try and make technical things, basically. So you'd try and make like, at the time it was a big deal to have like a spinning wireframe or something right. like that, or a 3D model, or yeah, I would have like this terrible like polygonal head that would like talk and stuff like that. And thankfully, like none of them are on like the internet or YouTube or anything. So like there were at the time, I was more just in love with the scene. So there's like a demo yeah. scene and you would go on and there's people who are far better than me, doing stuff. And so I would just be part of that. I would be like whatever on forums and asking questions and stuff like that. Yeah. And yeah, luckily none of them existed. They would have had music that was written by me on there as well. So
we need a let's play of that immediately.
If any of them do still exist and I find them, then they will be immediately destroyed.
So was it at age six when you started messing around that you with games that you knew you wanted to make them for a living, or was it not until the Super Mario 64s or the Quakes, or was it even sometime after? What was the point where you said, I want to do this?
So my parents tell me that I was always saying that I wanted to work in video games. I don't feel like I knew that until like later on. And I would actually say, like, even later on in life, when I was in like university and stuff like that, I thought, I kind of thought games, people who worked in games were like, you know, it's like I couldn't possibly do that, right? Like that's for the John Carmacks of the right. world or whatever. Like I loved games, I loved reading about them and stuff like that. I actually I was in like my final year of uni, and that to me, I was super interested in games. It was just all I was doing. Spend all my time reading about it, making stuff and things like that. But I still felt at that stage I hadn't thought it was a possibility. Does that make any yeah. sense to you?
Yeah, you didn't have that sort of belief in yourself, maybe?
Well, I just thought, how do you even... this is the embarrassing thing. I thought it would be like you would make something and then somebody would notice it, you know what I mean?
Right.
They would reach out and they would be like, you'd get this email from like John Carmack or therefore like Peter Molyneux, you know, have you thought of making games? And you're like, yes, it's happened, you know?
You've made an offer at the altar of game
people,
design.
Kind of like how, you know, people get like scouted for being models or something like
or
that.
Somebody
would see you on the street, you know, be like, hey. I actually remember there was so I was living in Ireland, and there's a magazine that we have, Edge magazine, sure, in Europe, and that's a mixture of kind of specialist and like trade magazine. So that used to have ads in it for looking for like programmers or whatever, because a lot of people in the industry read it. And I'd never seen the magazine before, and I remember just being in a newsagent's and kind of leafing through it and suddenly seeing that they were like adverts for like, you know, and lots of them for people, you know, are you a programmer? Do you have these skills? Do you want to? It's like, I could actually apply for a job kind of thing. You know, that was it. Yeah, I'm obviously not that clever, because I hadn't figured out that it was just a normal job and you could go and apply for it.
So had in school, were you an athlete? Were you into computers all the time? Were you, you know, because were you like me, kind of just off in the nerd crowd and mocked or bullied for playing games?
And then
are you laughing at all those people now?
The thing that I realized is that my whole life, I think, I think people who grew up in a certain generation, like me, you spent your whole time being embarrassed of playing games.
Yeah.
Like it was a thing that you would hide the fact that you were reading gaming magazines, or you would have, and it was tied in with like tabletop gaming probably, right, or, you know, interested in all the kind of the dark arts of like nerd stuff.
Yeah.
Right.
I know what you mean.
like tech or electronics, whatever, that was all like super nerdy. And you would just kind of, you would know that you should be embarrassed of that. Like, I actually think we carry loads of that baggage with us, if you know what I mean, as in the gaming industry does. We always feel a little bit apologetic for like playing games and making games and stuff like that, even though they've become so like part of everyday life, right? I was definitely that. Like, you have your couple of friends who you know you can talk to games about, and then you can't talk about it with anyone else, you know, that kind of thing. And I was definitely not sporty or anything. I was secondary school and stuff like that, I was probably a little bit that mixture of being a bit bored at school and probably massively awkward and used to get into lots of trouble and stuff like that, but that was about as kind of interesting as I got.
So you had the Amiga in the house. Were you drawn to the Amiga at the time, or was that just sort of what was in the house that you?
Oh no, I was. So, I think my brother got the Amstrad, and then I just spent all my time on it, kind of thing. And then I, like, from then on, that was all I ever wanted, was like the next.
Yeah.
The greatest thing, you know, fondest memories, if you've ever had like a console Christmas. You know, when you're a kid and you get a console, it's like, you know, it's the best feeling. These are the fondest memories kind of thing. So for me, I can remember, you know, getting consoles, sure, but the thing I would be like, so SNES or whatever, but the thing I would have been really excited about is like an Amiga, Amiga 500, Amiga 1200, you know, RAM upgrades, stupid things like that, right? You used to be able to get, you don't even want to get started, like you'd get like, whatever, 4 megabyte hard drives, things like that, right? And then, like in terms of what you could do, the Amiga was kind of always known as that. It was a machine that could play games, but really you could do quite a lot with it. It was like a mini PC. And then I moved on to PC. And that was that's a massive leap. Suddenly you have a proper machine that you can actually make something with, kind of thing.
So let's skip forward past university. Right. At what point do you get your first paying job? You know, you'd been looking through Edge.
Right.
You'd seen this. Oh, you can do this. Where does the first paying job come in?
Yeah, I was in university and I did like computer science because I was just programming was my thing. Mainly what I was doing was just programming for myself, programming my spare time, and making little projects and stuff. And then I actually left uni. My first paying job was like what you would normally do after computer science. And I was working as like IT. I was working as like IT consultant. And it wasn't for me, right? Working at a big company with lots of people that you have nothing in common with,
right,
kind of thing. It was actually that similar thing of like I would have to feel embarrassed about the fact that I was, you know, really into computers and really now we get excited about stuff. And so I was like constantly thinking, right, I would love to work in video games, and actually kind of started applying and went to the UK and did a bunch of interviews and stuff like that. I hadn't realized that all the stuff that I'd done had made me reasonably like qualified and stuff like that. And so I got a bunch of like job offers and stuff. And the biggest thing for me, like going into these places, was suddenly seeing like, this is a place where everyone's like me, you know? That's the big difference in working in games, where you're like, I can walk into work in the morning and
say, with your head held high.
Yeah, well, you can say like, who's interested in seeing the new Star Wars film? And it's like, everyone is, obviously, because that's what you do, you know? Or who's excited about this game that's coming out or whatever, you know? My first job was with Criterion. Who are the folks that did like all the Burnout games and a bunch of Need for Speed and Black and stuff like that.
Yeah, and that was my favorite thing when I was researching you for this interview. You know, I know you a little bit, but I wanted to see all right, what am I missing? And turns out you were the technical lead on what is my favorite racing game of all time. And that is Burnout 3. You start there, and then you end up before... which Burnout did you start with?
So, when I joined Criterion, I did loads of different things on Burnout 3. I was technical lead at Criterion, but not on Burnout 3, but I'll tell you, I'll explain anyway. But I started a Criterion when it was really small. Like, that's a thing that... people didn't realize, I don't think. I actually went to... I interviewed at Rare, right?
Oh, wow.
And Rare was a big deal at the time.
Oh, yeah.
And Rare was like the... Yeah, they were at the top of their game at the time. And they'd done some of my favorite games, like GoldenEye and stuff like that. And I interviewed at Rare, and I got offered a job there, which was like my ultimate dream, right? I'd always wanted to work at Rare. And then, weirdly, I had this interview at Criterion, and I was like, oh, I also want to interview, like, I'd already arranged it. And I was like, well, I'm going to take the job at Rare, but I'll go and see them anyway. And they were, like, a little-known studio at the time. They'd done, like, Trickstyle and Airblade and games of...
Pre-Burnout.
Right, exactly. So they... I went down, and they were tiny, and they had, like, this residential house that all the walls had been knocked down from. And there was, like, 10 people working on Burnout 1, right? And... Rare, who I'd been to, was what most... They were quite a big studio at the time.
Yeah.
And they were what most studios look like now, which was like hundreds of people all lined up in rows kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd seen that, and I was like, this isn't what I'd expected video games to be like,
right,
but I guess this is what it's like. And then I went to Criterion, and they were like small and scrappy, and I loved it. I was like, this is what I expected video games to be like. Like, as in, you know, just a bunch of people in their bedroom, pretty much, you know. So I took a job there. And so they had... it was the cusp of, like, Burnout 1, Burnout 2 kind of thing. I started there as, like, a junior programmer. But they were so small and they got big so quickly that I was quite lucky that I kind of got to move up.
Yeah, right on the ground floor.
Yeah, so like I joined and there was like maybe 20 people in Criterion Games. And then when I left, it was about 4 or 5 years later. And there was like 350, wow. 400 people there, something like that. So that's like, you know, there are people basically from when I joined onwards, there were people just joining all the time and it was just getting bigger and bigger. And so I was lucky enough on Burnout 3, which is like one of my favorite games to have worked on, to have just been there early enough to do, to kind of have a reasonable sized role on it and to work on like gameplay and graphics and a whole bunch of different stuff.
Did you guys know with Burnout, because Burnout 3, I mean, 2 was successful and mm-hmm. that's 2 in my opinion, and at least in my memory, is where yeah. it sort of found itself.
Yeah.
But 3 was yeah. was the catapult, I think, for that series, and that's where everybody really fell in love with it. Yeah. Did you guys know that you had something pretty special with that, or was it not till it came out and everybody just found it, and were you surprised?
Yeah, it's weird, right? So one big thing was that was the first one that was published by EA.
Right.
So I think that's why people knew about it more.
Yeah,
so
Acclaim published the other two, as I
That's recall. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
And so that's a massive difference. So we knew that that was like a big deal. Like this is going to be a big game potentially,
yeah.
right? And it had the biggest team on it. It was like 30 people was on Burnout, right? So we, like, video games are strange. People don't really realize it from the outside. And when you work on it, you sort of realize it, that games don't find themselves normally, not for the longest time, not until normally the last couple of months of development. And that was sort of how I remember Burnout 3 being. So the idea came first, right? The
yeah.
idea was, it's going to be called Burnout Takedown, and it's going to be a racing game, but it's also going to be almost like a fighting game.
Yeah.
Cars are going to knock into each other. And what's really strange, imagine that you have that idea that like Alex, who was the creative director there, was like, pitches this idea to the team, this is what it's going to be, EA get behind it, everyone's on board with the idea, and we haven't, like, we haven't decided that that will definitely work, you know what I mean? Like, so, and actually the idea of racing and smashing up against another car, it seems very obvious now that you've seen it.
Right.
But at the time, it sort of doesn't make any sense. You're butting into cars and
that was
flying.
Like, that was sort of off limits, and
yeah.
like racing games didn't do that. Like,
yeah.
well, you don't crash on purpose.
Yeah,
you don't.
And it was like it didn't make any sense as well. Like because what you don't realize is that if you just do it naively, cars just race around a track, and actually they're always quite far apart. You know, the chances of you being right beside another car, having the ability to take them out,
yeah.
and even if you do, seeing that that happens, like that's a weird thing that wouldn't necessarily work. I think my recollection, and I don't know, this is probably totally wrong, and like people from Criterion will be texting me, friends from back then, really, this wasn't how it happened. My recollection was like that it wasn't quite fitting together, and we had like a magazine, like official PlayStation in, and I think a couple of us came in on the weekend to try and actually make the takedowns work, kind of thing. And that was when it formed into, like, I think there's about 3 of us, and it was like, an AI driver is going to drive your car for a little bit after you do a takedown. I don't know if you realize that that's what happens.
Huh.
Right. Because you can't steer anymore. Well, normally what would happen is you would crash into something, and then the camera would go and look at it.
Right.
When it went to look at it, you would just like crash into the wall, right? Because you're driving. So actually what happens is the AI takes control of your car. So that was one of our things. The camera was pulling back and looking at this other car, right? But by the time it had come back, you were like way down the track.
Yeah.
And you'd lost all sense of context. So we slowed down time, which made a big difference. And we also pulled the camera back, whilst keeping the car on screen. So actually the camera comes back rather than looking, kind of thing. So it comes all the way back and it stays. So basically the camera stays, and I'm going into way too much detail.
No, it's cool.
So I remember us coming in, out over a weekend, and then like we weren't in the room, but like Alex was showing the game to official PlayStation,
yeah,
and then kind of came out and was like, "It's good, guys."
It all sort of came together.
But what's even stranger about that is then. So, like, I worked on Crash Mode, on Burnout 3, and stuff like that. And
I love you so much.
But I'll give you an example of what games development's like. We were testing that game once we'd finished working on it, right? And I'd been fixing bugs, yeah. And I was one of the last people still fixing bugs on it. And that's not a good thing. That means I just had the most bugs, right? So I was fixing bugs, and everyone else stops working on it and is just testing. You have a QA team as well who's testing, but there's nothing else for you to do. You can't do any more.
Right, it's all locked, right?
It's all locked, and so everyone's just playing. And the way I think we did it at Criterion, which is an insight into EA and video games and stuff like that, so you had a choice. You could come in during the day and do a 16-hour shift of testing, or you could come in overnight and do a 12-hour shift, right? So I spent, I think, 3 weeks playing Crash Mode on Burnout 3, like 12 hours, like every night,
yeah.
Basically. Me and one other guy. And like it's 100 tracks on Crash Mode, and we could do every one of them in about an hour or
so
something like that.
You must be really good at Crash Mode.
I can Burnout 3 Crash Mode. I can guess like the maximum multiplier just without even looking. I can still picture every track. But by the time you've done that, you can't see the game anymore. Like you can imagine what it's like. You've probably had to record stuff for video here or something like that, where you've had to do it over and over again.
Yeah.
But once you've done it like 100 times, 1,000 times, we had no idea that the game was good. In fact, we were like, this game is awful. Like, because all you're seeing is all the problems.
Right.
And they're your problems. And you're like, I can't fix them. You know what I mean? Because the game's locked now. And you're just like, oh, God, this is terrible. And you can't enjoy it because obviously, like, I would be talking to the guy beside me and just, like, getting the maximum score and
right.
stuff like that. So like, what even is this? I was actually on a real low after we finished the game.
Interesting.
I was like, it's one of the lowest times in development. I normally get a bit down after every game I've worked on comes out, because you're just like, it's kind of an anticlimax, you know? But then the reviews came in, and yeah, Burnout 3 did like incredibly well.
Was it your favorite of the Burnouts?
I'll be killed by the other guys of Criterion.
Pick
but
your favorite
kid. Let's go. Yeah, yeah. But definitely, like, 3 is I think, really nailed it, you know. Yeah, definitely. Yeah,
that's my 2. One of the rumored... I'm sorry, I'm really hooked. When I learned that you were at Criterion, which is... I love that studio and the Burnout era. Just, like, one more Criterion question. One of the rumored... You guys were connected to a Road Rash reboot for a little while. What about that?
That's good homework. Yeah, I don't know what's been announced there, but
Leaked
or whatever. It never happened. Yeah, I think there was a studio that was working on it that was using the Burnout engine, and there was this discussion of, like, you know, a Burnout Road Rash reboot kind of thing that married the two. Which I think would have been awesome.
That's like the best idea I've ever heard.
The Road Rash was, it was one of my favorite games. Like, it's an awesome game. Like, it's just got a great kind of arcadey feel. Yeah, I would have loved to work on a Road Rash game.
So, all right, you.
As a podcast network, our first priority has always been audio and the stories we're able to share with you. But we also sell merch. And organizing that was made both possible and easy with Shopify. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell and grow at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell everywhere. They have an all-in-one e-commerce platform and in-person POS system, so wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. With the internet's best converting checkout, 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms, Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers. Shopify has allowed us to share something tangible with the podcast community we've built here, selling our beanies, sweatshirts, and mugs to fans of our shows without taking up too much time from all the other work we do to bring you even more great content. And it's not just us. Shopify powers 10% of all e-commerce in the U.S. Shopify is also the global force behind Allbirds, Rothy's, and Brooklinen, and millions of other entrepreneurs of every size across 175 countries. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/realm, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/REALM now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/realm.
Hey, it's Mae Whitman, and I play Frankie in the new Realm podcast, The Sisters. The Sisters is about a museum curator of medical oddities who investigates the origins of a mutated skeleton with two layers of bones. Soon, she uncovers an extraordinary mystery that connects her present with one family's tragic past in hauntingly dangerous ways. Listen to The Sisters wherever you get your podcasts.
You also, you said in your little Hello Games profile on the site that you love arcade racers, you know, between Burnout, you mentioned Mario Kart and Excite, I love Excite Bike from my Nintendo childhood too, Super Monkey Ball, which, so all of that very much explains that you would start your own studio and make a game like Joe Danger, which was an excellent game in its own right, but how does... How do we get to No Man's Sky from all those, from Joe Danger and all of these arcade racers?
I think, I don't know what you're like, right? But a lot of people that I meet in games have this same personality as me, where there's games that I want to play, and then there's games that I feel I have to play. Like, I feel I have to play every game that comes out, pretty much. Not every game now, because there are too many. But like as a kid, you felt like you could just about keep on top of it.
Yeah.
And if people were talking about a game, you feel like you had to have played it at least enough to know about it. And then I'm that really annoying guy that you meet who's played everything, or he's got all the consoles or whatever. And he, you know, you go around his house and he brings you in and he's like trying to convince you that you have to get this game.
Yeah.
You know, he's like, sit down, this would be for you. And you know, I get like a, whatever, when I get a new console, even now, I will show my friends or whatever. And when I get like a new, like the VR headsets and stuff like that, I'm like, I have to bring people in. I'm like, you got to try this out, you know. I think I've got a reasonably like eclectic taste in games or widespread taste in games, at least.
Yeah.
Like, I love, like, Mario Kart, right? Mario Kart on the SNES is the only Mario Kart. Mario Kart Battle Mode is, like, one of my all-time favorites. But then I would also love Elite. I would love Star Control.
Sure.
You know, I would love things that are just completely different. I think there's a lot of people... I think you find a lot of gamers who are really, they're widespread in what they'll play and what they'll do, compared to people who are into, say, films or books or whatever, you know. Normally people will be like, oh, I like fantasy books or whatever, whereas you don't see people who are necessarily just, I like fantasy games.
So Joe Danger, which is the first game when you start your own studio, Hello Games, it was a really good game. How do you feel about it now, like years later with the benefit of hindsight?
I'm super proud of Jet Angel. I hope this doesn't sound weird or bad, given that we're surrounded by No Man's Sky stuff, but I would be more proud of JD than I would be of No Man's Sky, kind of thing. Just because No Man's Sky is just a concept right now, you know, it hasn't come out, but yeah. Joe Danger came out, and we created that, four of us from nothing,
yeah.
And it came out, and then lots of people played it, you know, and I've seen their reaction, and I've had people say it to me and stuff like that, and so I know, as a programmer, there's not really that much more that I could do that would be as impactful as that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not that sounds really pretentious, but you know what I mean. It's like if a million people played Joe Danger, and whatever, if they only put an hour into it, you know, that's hey, that's pretty crazy, you know. And Joe Danger was a really fun, happy game. So
yeah.
You always get people saying to you, oh, I had a really good time, or played it. We did this thing at the end of all the JDs. If you 100% it, it gives you, an email address, right? And you can mail it, and that's called, the 100% club, right?
Nice.
And if you ever want to, you know, if I ever want to feel good about myself, you know, you can dip into this email address. And it's all people will normally, it says, oh, you're in the 100% club, here's this email, mail us what you thought or whatever.
Yeah.
And you get this really cool stuff. So you get people who are I've had all sorts, people who are in their 80s who've played Jet Angel.
Wow.
People who are, you know, either in hospital or they're, fighting abroad or stuff like that you really wouldn't expect,
yeah,
kind of thing. And you get a lot of, bored students and things like that. people tell you really fun stuff about themselves and stuff. But that's a really, that's a real thing. You know
yeah.
what I mean? And it still happens. People still play JD. They still play it on iPhone and stuff like that. I'm super proud of it. At the time when it came out, you don't feel that way. You're like, oh, God, it's kind of anticlimactic or whatever. Now it's actually that I can kind of appreciate it, you know?
So did you feel like you had to make that game so that you knew how to make your own game before you could do something like No Man's Sky?
Yeah, I mean, it sounds, I don't like saying that because it sounds dismissive of Joe Danger, but we did, it was definitely a stepping stone,
yeah.
And we said that at the time, we said it to each other in Hello Games, we were we're going to do this, and then the aspiration that we would do something much bigger. When we left our jobs, and there was four of us, and I was sort of trying to convince the guys to leave their job, which right now, as you know, everyone goes and becomes an indie, right? We were doing it before it was cool. You know? We're like the original hipster indies. No, we were doing it. We left and started a studio and started making a game kind of pre-Braid. It then came out just after that, and
yeah.
Castle Crashers and stuff like that. But there wasn't really, XBLA was just not really a thing. You'd had Geometry Wars on it. PSN had Warhawk. There was no App Store. This makes me sound really old. But it's not that long ago. Yeah. Right? But yeah, it's hard to remember. But so the idea of leaving when I left, people were like, what are you going to do? Where are you going to, you're going to make a game. Who's going to buy it? You're going to sell it on your own site? You know, that kind of thing. That was the attitude.
Yeah.
I was trying to convince the guys to leave and that this is a good idea. And I sent them a bunch of images, right? So one of the sets of images was loads of skyscrapers, right? And I was like, this is what we're making now, right? We're making these massive games that are really functional,
yeah.
and are kind of made to blueprints. Because at this stage, we were now on like Burnout 5 and...
Revenge and Black and...
And I done Black, and we were heading into like Black 2 and stuff like that. And so it's like, this is what we're making now, right? And the team size was getting really big, like you would have to build a big skyscraper or whatever. And then I sent them all these images, really pretentious of me, right? But I sent them all these images of, like, Swedish architecture and stuff like that. Like, cool houses, like, a house that was just set on a lake and a house on an island. The kind of thing that you would, if you saw, you would stop your car and you would look at it, you know? And be like, oh, I'd like to live there, kind of thing. I was like, wouldn't you like to make something like this? This is what I want to make, something that's really personal that people can look at a screenshot of and really like and get excited about. And one of the guys said, cool, let's do that, right? And this makes him sound totally over the top, but he was like, let's do that, but only if we go on and make a skyscraper of our own, right? Like afterwards, right? And he was, that sounds really like over the top, but he was trying to be funny. Like it was an aspirational, it was stupid, obviously, because there was four of us. So it was one of these stupid things to say that's like, you know, yeah, we'll, you know, but we're going to make, like, we're going to make a big AAA game, right, you know. And it was like, that was funny. So we had, on our website, we had like games that, for years, we had games that Hello Games make, and it was Joe Danger, and then underneath it would say Project Skyscraper kind of thing. So that was what No Man's Sky then turned out to be. That was, we kept talking about it, kind of thing. So yeah, it was always meant as a stepping stone, but we figured it would take years and years and years. Like we would get bigger and bigger or something like that, you know.
But doesn't work that way. You end up off. You start it in secret from the rest of the team. Then it's you get the whole team involved, and then finally, the VGA Awards, December 2013.
Yeah,
you bring a trailer, and you decide that's where you're announcing the game. Mm. Were you expecting the incredible reaction you got to that?
No, definitely not. What kind of person would? We were super nervous about that. We were originally talking to Jeff Keighley, who was putting together the VGAs.
Yeah.
And he knew that we were working on something, but he had no idea what it was. And he kind of contacted us. He'd actually happened to come to visit our studio, and he had been at Media Molecule, and we're near to Media Molecule, so he just called in on his way past. And nobody had been to our office, kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And we'd done this really weird thing of boxing off one room, and we'd covered it in sci-fi book covers. We'd like bought a load of sci-fi books and then cut off the covers and put them all on the wall, right? And everyone else was still working on Joe Danger. And we'd gone into this little room to work on something in secret.
Yeah.
And we had, like, literally, like, boxed off the walls. No one could get in, kind of thing. And we had our own little entrance and stuff. And Jeff just saw that and was like... we were like, cover up your screens, you know. And he was just like, what are you guys doing in here? And I think we were so... like shifty and suspicious about it that he was like, they must be doing something amazing or something, you know. All the visuals of what we were, you know, that were on the walls and stuff were so different to Joe Danger.
Yeah.
So he was like, I don't know what you guys are doing, but if you can do a good trailer, then, you know, we could have you on VGAs or whatever. So we just went like, oh my God, we've got to bring together this trailer. And we brought it together and sent it to him, and I sent it off and then actually started showing people. I was like friends and stuff like that. And I was like, I asked them kind of one question at the end. So it's just like a 90-second trailer. And I was like, right, I'll give you no context. I'm going to show you this thing. What do you think? should this be on the VGA? Is this game ready to announce or whatever?
Yeah.
And everyone apart from one person said no. So we actually, I like contacted Jeff and I was like, can we pull the trailer kind of thing? So at that stage, he had kind of already fought to get us a place there and a slot. And he was like, I think it's all right. You guys should show it. And I think it'll, you know. And yeah, like we, I remember the discussion was that we felt that we didn't even know what we were, like what kind of reaction we were going to get.
Yeah.
So at the start of the trailer, it was like, it used to say like, from the people who brought you Joe Danger or whatever. But then that just seemed so weird with the game that it was. So we were just like, just take it off. Like,
yeah.
Let's not associate Hello Games with this thing. Like, we don't know how this is going to go. Kind of thing. But yeah, I thought that I was heading into some sort of like, not disaster, but like, you know, this may not go well. There's part of you that's like, well, maybe everyone's wrong and it'll go, you know, because you're looking at it and you're kind of proud of what you're doing and you're like, this is cool. Yeah. But we had no idea. We certainly weren't thinking this is going to be huge or anything like that.
So does overnight then, are you reinvigorated? Are you terrified because everybody likes it? What's the internal reaction at Hello?
I had the closest to what I would call like a Mighty Ducks moment. You know what I mean? Right? So I, because we thought...
What, like quack?
Yeah.
Rallying the team kind of thing?
Like, you know...
pounding the sticks?
You know how like in films they end and everyone's happy, you know? Like,
yeah.
I think that's how they all like cheer and then it freeze frames and the music comes up, right? Like that kind of the underdog and they've won, you know, that
right.
kind of thing, right? So I'd never been on camera and stuff like that, really, like, not in that way, and we did the VGAs. I went on, and that was just a blur. I don't even know what I said, but I came on after the trailer, talked to Jeff, mm-hmm. and then walked out, and the way it's filmed, there's these, like, doors you walk through, and then you come back out, and there's, when you come back out, there's all these people that I would know, like Tim Schafer and stuff like that, you know. And it was like all these kind of famous gaming people. And they've all been watching it on the screen and it's gone down well kind of thing. So I like walked out and there was the four of us that worked on No Man's Sky up until that point.
Right.
The other three were there. And so I walked out and there's like, you know, so it's this stupid movie moment where like Tim Schafer's there, who I've, like, admired, you know, and it's like, good job, you know, and it's like, you're walking down, and everyone's like, yeah, that looked cool, and stuff like that, you know, and then I go down to the guys, and they're like, we're trending on Twitter, you know, and stuff like that, so you have this, that was awesome, like, that was just the best moment, you know what I mean, and we're all, like, hugging and stuff like that, because we thought we were heading for, like, all the worst things are going on in your mind.
Yeah,
basically.
The other three, they've followed you into the, into the desert, basically, yeah, yeah. right?
Yeah, so, and then there's all the people who are back home watching
sure.
it, because it's, like, 3 a.m, and people have stayed up, and they're all, like, texting you and stuff, and my phone was just going crazy. Yeah, so it was cool, it was awesome. Obviously, that's, like, you're like, let's make this. I mean, it was just a blur. We got on a plane heading back. And, like, the great thing when there's four of you is you just fit in a row, you know. And I remember Grant, who's down the other end, you know. And he turned to us and he was like, Sean's just laid the golden egg. We've all just got to carry the golden egg now, you know. We got to make this thing, you know. But we were so excited heading back from that. Yeah, it was amazing. The team, the rest of the team, didn't really know what we were doing, you know. So that was a pretty crazy thing for them. They had been working on Joe Danger and enjoying it and stuff, but it's obviously a big leap, you know.
So you come back from the highest of highs, and not too long after,
yeah.
your office is decimated in a flood.
Yeah.
Did you think the game was done, or were you? Did you have a? Was there a panic, or were you just instantly like, okay, we've got backups, it's fine?
What? Yeah, it was a couple of weeks later, and it was Christmas Eve, and we were all off from work. And the whole office flooded, which is a crappy thing, obviously. I think if we hadn't announced the game, because I nearly backed out of it,
right.
Obviously. I think if we had backed out of it and then had been flooded, it's hard to know. I think we might have, just canned No Man's Sky, because
wow.
I think we would have been feeling really unsure of it. You know, when we were trying to back out of it, we were just like, what have we been doing? I mean, it's an awkward thing, because we didn't lose, we obviously had some backups and stuff like that, but you lose a lot of work. And we couldn't really talk about that, because generally we just announced, people would have been angry and stuff like that. You know, they'd be like, people don't understand, obviously you're a small team.
Right.
And we came back into the studio Christmas Day, the whole team just kind of reassembled, and we'd had this. This sounds really bad. I'm going to say the flood was a really good thing that happened to us, right? So we'd had this thing where we'd had a team of 10, and there was 4 people who'd gone off in a room and done this thing, and then 6 people who'd kind of watched and not been as involved. And some of them would have felt the same way we did, which is they would have seen the No Man's Sky trailer just before it went out at the VGAs, and thought, I'm not sure how this is going to go down, kind of thing. And then when we came back, we were like, right, everyone needs to work on this. We need to ramp up the team.
Yeah.
You know, we all want to be working on this. But it's a weird thing for them. They're like, you know, you...
Because they haven't been involved.
Yeah, and we're...
just like, hey, yeah. Work on this thing that I've done without you.
yeah. And we're, we're all good friends, and there wasn't any problem, but it was... slightly odd feeling, right?
They weren't creatively invested in it at that point, is that fair to say?
I think the two teams had diverged a little bit. We had had a bunch of experiences that they hadn't, and they had had a bunch of experiences that we hadn't. And so you can't... Anyway, it's just... And it needed, a bonding thing, and that's what happened, right? All of us just kind of reassembled to, just throw out everything in the office, all our equipment, and build all new PCs and all of this kind of thing. And we ended up in this tiny little room with 10 of us crammed in there on makeshift desks and stuff like that. It looked like the workshop at Dell or something like that. There was just computer parts everywhere. Just trying to dry stuff out or salvage stuff or build new stuff. And it was really bonding. And I remember saying to the team, yes, it's crappy and stuff like that, but imagine, it's just, I'm really bad for this kind of thing, but I was like, imagine what it's going to be like when we walk out on stage at E3 and, we show the game, in its fullest, and we can kind of really properly reveal it. And that was a stupid thing to say, because obviously we'd lost a bunch of work.
Yeah.
But it was a kind of we had no reason to think that we would be at E3 and stuff like that. But it was imagine that, work backwards from that. That'll be a cool moment, because obviously... And so we went silent that whole time between there and E3, which is kind of hard to remember back to, but we just said nothing, kind of thing. Because the truth was, hey, we've got loads of work to do now. Yeah, so we just went quiet, and we kind of ramped up the team. More and more people joined from that other group of 6 and started building something for E3.
So when I saw you at last year's E3, fast-forwarding a couple of E3s, you had told me that you met that same day. We met at night to see the game. That day, you'd been over to meet with Elon Musk, and then you took a meeting. I guess you showed Steven Spielberg the game.
Right.
So did you request those meetings? Did they want to speak with you? What's the story with those? Because that's a heck of a day for anyone. Elon and now Spielberg.
And I think my favorite part of that was like Kanye was at E3 that year, and we got a message that he had said he wanted to see the game kind of thing, and we weren't, because we're self-funded and stuff like that, so we weren't actually on the show floor at E3.
Right.
We were like, we're not on the show floor, and he's like on the show floor or whatever, walking around, and we're like, and we've got Elon Musk to meet and Steven Spielberg, so... You know, we can't take that Kanye meeting kind of thing. It's one of my favorite things, you know. That was a weird day. That will go down as like one of... This game, I don't know, it has put me in one weird situation after another. Every time I think things have been their most surreal, then something else happens. But that day we got contact from... like Elon Musk's secretary or something like that, and she was like, "Oh, like it's such a weird mail, you know." And Elon Musk would like to meet with you, and he's in
a
LA,
gamer.
Yeah, and he made he started out programming games. You know, he made a game. I think it's called Blaster. And that was kind of like the first money he made, basically. And he's a programmer.
So what do you talk to Elon Musk about? If his office reaches out.
Yeah, so we got a tour of SpaceX, that would be a big deal for me. Anyone would want that, but it was so cool. Amazing, it's an amazing place, like what they're doing there. And so we got a tour, and then we just sat and chatted to him. And we had the same reaction that you have, which is like, what are we going to talk to him about? I would be a big fan of his and stuff. And we talked about loads of stuff. We just talked about normal things. I mean, obviously, he's a normal person and stuff. We talked about laptops, you know, and stuff like that. He's buying a laptop. I was giving him recommendations. He's an incredibly nice guy and obviously super, super smart, you know. And we were talking about, like, AI, and at the time it hadn't been announced, but he was talking about how he was working on and telling us a lot about how he's working on the self-driving car stuff and
autopilot.
He's heading that up and some of the problems and just loads of things. He's fascinating. I mean, he has kind of a way of talking that you're not, like, he's obviously thinking as much as he's talking, if that makes sense.
It does, yeah.
Right? And so we would keep waiting for him to just like ask us to leave, and we ended up staying there. Like he had other meetings and they were like queuing up waiting for him, and people kept coming in and saying like your next meeting's here and stuff like that. But we just stayed and chatted. It was really, really good to chat to him.
Wow. And then Spielberg?
Yeah, so we went straight from that back to E3, back in the center of LA, and we'd already met with some of Steven Spielberg's like production designers and stuff like that. They're working on a film, and they wanted to know. Well, I guess they're working on Ready Player One,
yeah.
Right? And I guess there's some crossover there with something like No Man's Sky, so they were just asking us a bunch of questions and wanted to see it, and you know, because Ready Player One is about like a gaming world that you go and inhabit and has like an infinite number of planets and right. things like that. So there's some like weird crossover. Yeah, yeah. So we were just talking to them about how it work, you know, how our game works and how games work and stuff like that. Like, I think he's quite into games and stuff like that.
Yeah, he's developed, Boom Blocks?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, yeah, and worked at EA for a while. Yeah, so just super interesting to show him the game.
So, No Man's Sky, you've talked a lot about wanting No Man's Sky to feel like you're walking into the science fiction. You cut out space or sci-fi novel, you've talked about... So you would literally walk into those novels, and you've said that you want the game to feel like that as well. So what are some of your favorite novels, sci-fi novels?
The one... If anyone ever asked me, like, oh, I'm... someone asked me recently, like, oh, I'm kind of... I feel like I've never read much sci-fi. Where should I start?
Yeah.
Whatever. And I think the one that I always recommend is not a... It's not actually a good place to start. It's like, it's just that it's my favorite book. So Dune is like my, you know, it's like 2,000 pages long. And I just read it in like 2 days or something like that. I just consumed that book. But it's just a brilliant book. I've never, anyone who makes it past the first 100 pages always just gets totally like... consumed by it. I think it's complex and things like that, but it brings, I don't know, I'm not doing a very good job of explaining this, but like, it is all the things that sci-fi should be, I think, right? Like, in terms of I think sci-fi, for me, good sci-fi will put forward the idea of something science related that's different. So imagine a world where technology can do this, right? So whether it's like, robots are sentient, or, you know, you can see the future, or you can predict a crime, or you can, you know, and then tries to build that out with knowing what we know about people and stuff like that. Let's build that world out fully and explore it, right? And imagine what that would be like. And then as you read it, to me, it tells you, it's a way of exploring a certain part of like life or something like that. You know what I mean? Like, so you're, that's good sci-fi to me. And Dune is just such a, it puts forward the idea that there's spice and it's incredibly valuable and kind of explores this whole world of like, builds out this universe of pirates and the sandworms, and you know, it just seemed very complete, basically.
So, speaking of stepping into science fiction worlds, virtual reality.
Right.
Everyone that's been interviewing you has been trying to get a straight answer out of you regarding, because, of course, Sony has now confirmed sort of all the details for PlayStation VR. It's out in October. Base package, $400, $500 for the, you know, with the other accessories. So No Man's Sky would, on paper, be an incredible fit for a VR situation. What do you got? can you announce anything? What is the status of PlayStation VR, or... were you being super cagey and that it's, well, on PC, someone's just going to hack the PC version for Oculus in like 2 days? So where do we stand with VR support of any sort with No Man's Sky?
So I think, what can I say? I think, I'll answer it this way, I guess, right? VR, like, I've tried out all the headsets and everything, right? And as a coder and somebody who's like a tinkerer, you know, obviously I would try stuff out, right?
Sure.
And I think VR in general is incredibly exciting. Like, I wouldn't necessarily say, like, I would say I'm a believer. I have this like optimism about it. I really hope everyone gets it right, right? I feel like it doesn't have like a killer app, and I hope, you know, no one gets offended by that. But like that thing that you, I haven't made sense of, am I going to play it for 3 hours straight or five hours straight or whatever? I have definitely decided, you know, that I'm going to own a VR headset and then I'm going to show all my friends because I'm that kind of guy, and I'm going to try and convince them to buy one, you know. And I hope that it kind of finds that killer app, by which I mean that everyone ends up needing one, you know, kind of thing. That it doesn't become novelty or gimmicky, because I think it's such an amazing opportunity, kind of thing. I think it would, I think it would be a really good fit for No Man's Sky, you know. I think like the idea of, a thing I think about a lot is that, and I don't think people have fully grasped this, is like, if you were to put on a headset, often people will say, well, you can't wear one for 5 hours, or it strains my eyes, or whatever. I think there's this huge opportunity for playing a game normally, but then also being able to have those really intense moments within a game, you know, to have a mixture of both.
Yeah.
Right? You know, if it was No Man's Sky, if such a thing existed, being able to find a planet that you really loved and then be able to see it in 3D, I think something like that would be incredibly cool.
All right, so maybe you'll do it yourself, but if not, you might, you will be encouraged to see the community do it. Is that?
I don't know what I can say to that. All I can say is like, obviously, we're a super small team. I think everyone would want us just focused on the game and getting it out and getting it as good as possible, kind of thing. And
right.
I think VR is definitely a cool thing.
I tried, folks. I tried to get it out of it. Sean Murray, the programmer and just mathematic mastermind behind No Man's Sky. The game is No Man's Sky. It's out in June for PlayStation 4 and PC. Maybe one day PlayStation VR or some other PC VR device. Sean Murray, thank you so much. This was
an
absolute treat for me. Thank you for Burnout 3. Thank you in advance for No Man's Sky. And for much more with the best and brightest, most wonderful people in the video game industry, keep it tuned every month to IGN Unfiltered on IGN YouTube or our IGN apps on your favorite devices.
Hello, friends. This is Mark Nell, executive producer of the Table Read podcast, where imagination meets performance. As we wrap up an incredible season one, we want to take a moment to express our heartfelt gratitude to each and every one of you who tuned in and supported us on this amazing journey. Season one was nothing short of extraordinary. We delved into captivating scripts that transported us to worlds beyond our imagination, thanks to the brilliant writers who delivered these works. But what really brought these stories to life were the talents of our amazing actors. But wait, the excitement doesn't end there. As we bid farewell to Season 1, we are thrilled to announce the launch of Season 2. Get ready for more gripping narratives, more unforgettable characters, and more mesmerizing performances that will keep you on the edge of your seat. We have some big surprises coming. The Force will definitely be with you. So stay tuned, stay engaged, and most importantly, stay excited. From all of us at the Table Read Podcast, thank you. And let's make Season 2 even more memorable together.